Older kids, if you've got a Bible, you can turn to chapter 11 of the Gospel of John. Today we celebrate that Christ is risen. That hundreds of years ago, in a tomb in a garden just outside the walls of Jerusalem, Jesus stopped being dead. His body was laying there on Saturday night. No breath in his lungs. No blood moving through his heart. Still covered in the marks of being beaten and whipped and stabbed and crucified. And then he breathed. And then his heart beat, and he has been alive ever since. He is risen.
He's risen indeed.
Thank you, Christian. What difference does that make? I agree, Mia. All the difference. And yet, I really have lost count just this week of the number of times I've been reminded that Jesus is risen and all is not well. Right. Jesus is risen and marriages are still disintegrating. Jesus is risen and little children still have to go to the hospital. Moms and dads not knowing if they'll get to bring them back home from the hospital. Jesus is risen, and the wealthy and the mighty still inflict their whims on the poor and the powerless. Jesus is risen, and the bombs still fall. Jesus is risen, but so what? I guess you could say it's just not time for so what yet. That we believe, Christians believe, always have believed that Jesus, he rose from the grave and he ascended to heaven, and he's waiting there until the day when he's going to come back to earth and deliver the so what. When he'll put the wealthy and mighty in their place, he'll take the broken relationships and put them back together, he will heal every sickness and every wound, he will restore the creation itself, he will, as the creed says, come again in glory to judge the living and the dead someday. But what about today? What difference does he is risen make today? Jesus himself, a little more than a week before he rose from the dead, faced that question. Jesus himself faced that so what question in the form of two sisters. Sisters who absolutely believed in the someday. Absolutely believed in happily ever after with God someday. But sisters whose today was consumed with the reality that their brother Lazarus was dead. Jesus comes and he meets them, and how he responds to them, how Jesus faces death, shows us what difference he is risen makes today. That story, as I had you turn to, it's in John chapter 11, which if you didn't bring a Bible with you, there's hardback black Bibles in the pews or under the chairs, and it's on page 897 in those Bibles. You're welcome to look it up. This story is one of the longest and the richest and deepest and most subtle in the Bible. We're not going to plumb every depth or cover every aspect. I want to draw your attention to four features of the story this Easter Sunday. Four features of John 11. The agenda in the story, the life in the story, the love in the story, and the price in the story. The agenda, the life, the love, and the price. The agenda in the story, which is really, it's the agenda of everyone in the story except Jesus. They all share it in common. The agenda in the story is really simple. Don't die. They assume that the point of being alive, the purpose, the agenda is being alive, not dying. This is not by any means unique to the characters in John chapter 11. There's an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley right now. His name is Brian Johnson, and his goal is to stay alive. And so he's spent millions of dollars. He spends several hours every day on all sorts of schemes to slow and hopefully one day reverse the process of aging in his body, like organic vegan kale diet, supplements that I can't even pronounce, plasma injections, red light therapy, staying out of the sun so that the UV rays don't destroy his skin. And according to his calculations, he's slowed his aging by about 35% so far. And he's founded a company so that for a nominal fee, you too can slow your aging process and don't die as long as possible. The company is named very cleverly, Don't Die. That's his agenda. Now, I mean, I got a kick out of making fun of, you know, narcissistic Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. But this is not just for tech zillionaires. All of the people in John 11 except Jesus, people who know Jesus personally, people who have learned by heart large swaths of the first part of the Bible, have the same agenda. Just a few examples, not all of them in the text. In verse 8 of John chapter 11, the disciples, Jesus' closest followers, his closest students, reveal they are on board with the don't die agenda. Right? Jesus is, he's announced his plan to go back to the town where Lazarus and Mary and Martha are and visit them. And the disciples remember what happened the last time they were in that region. They almost died. And so they assume this is a bad idea. Right? Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you. You need to know that in the Gospel of John, Jews refers to the religious teachers, the power brokers. Everybody in the story is Jewish ethnically in the way we use the term Jews. So the religious leaders, the powerful, were just seeking to stone you. And are you going there again? You can't possibly be doing that. That would be totally counter to the don't die agenda. And then Jesus has these one-on-one encounters with each of Lazarus' sisters, and they start the same way. In verse 21, Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. The point was to avoid death, and we failed. Then Mary, in verse 37, sorry, that's the wrong one. Verse 32, she fell at Jesus' feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And then those very religious teachers in verse 37 said, could not he, Jesus, who opened the eyes of the blind man, which Jesus did just two pages ago, also have kept this man from dying? Everyone starts from the assumption. The point of life, the agenda is, don't die. And Lazarus is dead. So there has been some essential failure. Everyone takes this agenda for granted, that if you can delay death, and even better, if you can dodge the precursors to death, if you can avoid sorrow, prevent suffering, minimize difficulty, you absolutely should. The best life is the longest life with the least suffering. That's the agenda. We can relate to this, yes? Right? I mean, in modern society, we have tools at our disposal for not dying that Mary and Martha and the disciples couldn't imagine. And we use them for exactly that, for living the longest possible life with the least possible suffering. I remember another Christian teacher a few years ago describing his experience of being a parent. He said, "My goal is to get through the day without being miserable." Right? Is there anything sadder and yet more relatable? Right? In every sphere of life. Right? Like family, work, church. Like somebody came and talked to me this morning to deliver news of suffering and sorrow. And I was like, my instinctive reaction is, leave me alone. I just want to get through Easter Sunday without experiencing this kind of misery. I'm a part of the agenda. And so are you. Can you really blame any of us for participating in this agenda? Is there a problem with it? I mean, other than that it's delusional. Right? Other than that you are definitely going to die. And before you die, you are going to suffer a lot. Not only that, not only is organizing your life around this agenda of avoiding death delusional, it's actively self-defeating. If your priority and purpose in life is not dying, you will miss out on more of life than you would otherwise. We now know, we have like the sociological data to back up what God has been telling us for 4,000 years, that what actually makes a life worth living, what actually makes a life satisfying, is not length and is not the absence of suffering, but deep, loving relationships. Durable connection and community, joyful interdependence, mutual commitment. That's the essential ingredient for a good life. And you know what else that leads to? More suffering. Every meaningful relationship in your life, without exception, will be a source of suffering in your life. So if you're actually going to organize your life around the don't die agenda, what you're going to want to do is stay out of meaningful relationships. That will help you minimize suffering and waste the little bit of life that you've been given. The don't die agenda, it's practically universal, it's totally relatable, we all get it, and it's super dumb, foolish, delusional, and self-defeating. So what's the alternative? Is there actually another option? I mean, if everyone from ancient Judaism to modern Silicon Valley takes for granted the don't die agenda, maybe it's inevitable, just the way things are. But it's not everyone, is it? There is an exception in the story. There is an alternative. And that alternative is Jesus. He's the one person in the story who shows no interest in the agenda. He's up to something entirely different. He's not going to settle for the absence of death. He's after life. He's not going to pursue minimizing sorrow and suffering. He pursues love instead. This leads us into the second feature of the story. The first one is the agenda that everyone else has taken for granted. The second feature of the story is the life that Jesus lives and then offers to others. The life that death actually cannot take. So now we get into the interactions that Jesus has with Martha, the first sister. In verses 20 through 24, we see this encounter. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I would know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life." Right? Martha, she believes in that someday, right? That like someday everything's going to be fixed, all's going to be well, there's going to be a happily ever after. She thinks that's true, and it doesn't change the fact that her brother is dead today. It doesn't make a difference to her grief in this moment to know that there will be a moment, who knows how many moments from now, when things will be different. And Jesus says to her, "I'm not here for someday. I'm here for today." He doesn't say, "I will be the resurrection and the life someday." He says, "I am the resurrection and the life here and now in the face of death. I am the life death cannot take." Which, of course, is the sort of claim that is either true or utterly nuts. And Martha doesn't know which until verse 38 to 44. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." And when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Jesus is not just the sort of person who is willing to say things like, "I am the resurrection of the life," to a woman who is grieving her dead brother. He is the sort of person who is able to back up the claim, who is actually the embodiment of a life death cannot take, who is himself death proof. Jesus is communicating to Martha, "I don't care about preventing death because I have come to conquer it. I'm not interested in avoiding death because I am the end of death. It may look right now, today, as if death is the great sorrow that brings an end to all joy, the inevitable loss that wipes away all gain, the ultimate power that leaves all of us powerless. It may look that way, but I am here to show you it is not so. I can call Lazarus out of his grave, and I will walk out of my grave. So you don't need to be afraid of your grave." Jesus is explicit in what he says to Martha, that this isn't a one-time deal, some sort of like special demonstration of his power or dispensation for Lazarus. Jesus makes this offer to every single one of us. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" Jesus not only says, "I am the life death cannot take," he says, "I am offering you a life that death cannot take from you. I am offering you a life that conquers death." That, however marvelous it may be, is less relatable to everyday life than the whole don't die agenda. Believers in Jesus die. We know this from experience. Lazarus himself gets to die twice. He's dead at the beginning of the story. Jesus brings him back to life. And then sometime later, Lazarus does it all over again. So what is Jesus talking about here? It can't be a way to avoid death, to prevent it, to live a life that somehow bypasses death and keeps going along. It is rather a life that means, though you die, yet shall you live. A life that somehow can experience death and yet be alive. It's the difference between a tulip life and a maple tree life. Right? Tulips are annuals. Yes, Janet? Did I get that right? I got this. I don't know what that means. Right. Winter is the end of the tulip's life. It's all done. Seeds go in the ground. Those seeds can come back, but that particular tulip is done. Maybe? Google lied to me. All the gardeners are shaking their heads. Never mind. Some things, right? I really thought I did my research. For some plants. I will recover from this by next Easter, I'm sure. Some plants end at winter, right? The maple trees that line the church property experience winter. They don't get to bypass it, avoid it, prevent it, or escape it. But they remain alive through the winter and are usually stronger and more full of life the next year. Jesus is offering you not a life of perpetual and perfect summer, but a life that remains alive through the winter and even grows stronger and more fruitful as the winters go by. He is offering you a life that though you die, which you will, yet will you live. And he says it is for anyone who believes. Anyone who trusts in him to be the power that is stronger than death. The actual ultimate authority in human life. That's what he's inviting everyone from Martha to you and I into. A life of trusting in the power of his life. A life of belief that you don't have to organize yourself around living as long as possible and suffering as little as possible. You can live differently. You can live a life that you trust in Jesus will conquer death. And that life is marked by love. This is the third feature of the story that I want to draw your attention to. We had the agenda of avoiding death, the life that conquers death that Jesus claims to offer, and then the love that shares in death. This is what belief actually looks like, right? We're not talking about, I believe that there is an asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. This time I'm getting the thumbs up from the experts, right? I mean, I do believe that's true. I've never seen it with my own eyes, but I have it on good authority. I think it's real. It doesn't change anything about my life. Right? This is a belief that changes everything about my life by leading me into death-sharing love. Here we get to Jesus' encounter with the second sister in the story, with Mary. So we've already seen Jesus promise Martha this death-conquering life and then prove that he can deliver by bringing Lazarus back from the dead. That is a whole and satisfying and coherent story right there. Jesus can raise the dead. Hallelujah. And yet, Jesus doesn't go straight from proclaiming this life to Martha to giving Lazarus life. He takes what really seems like a detour. He knows perfectly well that he is going to bring Lazarus back to life and take away everyone's reason for being sad. And yet, look at what he does in verses 32 to 38. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled, and he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. What is Jesus doing? Why doesn't he just get to the happy ending of the story? Why won't he just fast forward to someday, when all the Lazaruses are raised to a life that will not end and all is made well? Like, wouldn't it be simpler and more efficient to go get Lazarus out of the tomb and then bring him to see Mary? Say, "Look, nothing left to cry about." And yet Jesus chooses to delay solving the problem so that he can share in Mary's sorrow, so that he can sit under the weight of death with her. That the word there that Jesus experiences twice of being greatly troubled, it's this visceral, evocative word. It gives the impression of almost like being squeezed in a vise until everything inside of you comes out in this cry of distress and difficulty. So you could picture Jesus almost like stumbling over and going, "Ooh!" There's nothing sort of dignified or pretty about it. It is him all the way into Mary's sorrow. He has borne our sorrows and carried our griefs. He has shared in the weight of death that we feel. Why did he do this? First, I mean, it reveals God's heart for a people who continue to wonder, why haven't you made everything better yet, God? If you have the power to do it, can we just get to the end? How long, O Lord? I don't know the answer to that. But I do know this God is right there with us under every weight of sorrow and grief and even death that we have experienced or will. There is no cup of suffering we taste that this God has not drained to the bottom. Jesus shows us that in his willingness to share in Mary's experience of death. And Jesus shows us how we who believe are to share in Jesus' death-conquering life. After Jesus makes his promise to Martha, "I am the resurrection of life. If you believe in me, though you die, yet shall you live forevermore." And then he does two things. He brings a dead man back to life. We can't do that. And he chooses to go and share in a weeping sister's experience of death. We can do that. We can live this death-conquering life by practicing the death-sharing love of Jesus. This has been the call and practice of believers in Jesus since the beginning. The examples abound. The one that I want to share that comes from the life of the early church, of this like moving towards those in grief and sorrow and in difficulty, practicing death-sharing life, has to do with little children. I got lost again. There's somewhere here. There we go. The followers of Jesus, they were born into and they started to spread out into the Roman Empire, which was an ancient society that didn't value children as people. For the Roman society, the first son was useful because he would inherit and carry on the family name and honor. And all of the other children were mouths to feed. And this was a big problem for most people in Roman life because they didn't have a lot of extra food or resources or the time and attention that a child requires that could have been going to acquiring food and resources. And so it became commonplace. If a child was born and it wasn't a boy or it was not the first boy, it was called exposing. Just find a quiet place that people didn't go by and leave the child in a back alley. We have a letter written by a Roman soldier just a few years before Jesus was born to his wife that combines these concerns. This is exactly what it says, translated from Latin. "If I receive my pay soon, wife, I will send it up to you. Above all, if you bear a child and it is male, let it be. But if it is female, cast it out." That is the don't die agenda. Raising children means suffering, means sorrow, means risk of death. So avoid it if you can. And the believers of Jesus started to practice the death-sharing love of Jesus. They learned the places where babies were often left, and they would check. And they would collect any babies that were there and raise those children as their own. Which is to say, they entered into a lifetime of greater sorrow, of more difficulty, of in a society where they too did not have extra resources, higher risk of death themselves for the love of these little ones no one else found worth loving. That is a life death cannot conquer because it is a life that embraces the possibility of death for the sake of love. This is the life of Jesus that he is offering to each and every one of us, a life of death sharing love, a life where you find out the answer to questions like, who would you embrace if you weren't afraid of being rejected? Who would you serve if you weren't afraid of being taken for granted? Who would you forgive if you weren't afraid of being hurt again? Who would you grieve with if you weren't afraid of having nothing helpful to say? Weren't afraid because you knew that in Jesus there is a God who embraces you, a God who serves you and forgives you and grieves with you. So it is not on you to be the source of death-sharing love. Jesus does that. It is on you to be what Paul, one of Jesus' disciples, calls being rooted in his love, like a maple tree that can draw life from the soil and thus participate in the death-sharing love of Jesus. This is the love that we are offered and the love that we are called into. So we've covered the agenda and the life and the love. Last is the price. We see Jesus sharing in Mary's death and offering Martha a death-proof life and raising Lazarus from the dead. That means Jesus is sharing in our death and offering us a death-proof life. But what is the cost? What is the price? This isn't fully revealed to us until the end of the story, although Jesus knows it the whole time. After Jesus has he's raised Lazarus from the dead, this is, we pick it up in verse 45 through 53. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him, but some of them went to the Pharisees, that's a group of the religious leaders, and told them that what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council, which is like the Congress of Israel. They gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." Caiaphas did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad, so that from that day on they made plans to put him to death. There is, I told you, rich and subtle and textures. There's so much there, right? Like Caiaphas is showing he's on like the don't die agenda, even if you have to make a sacrifice to minimize death. Right? And God is showing that he has woven Caiaphas into his greater agenda of death-conquering life through death-sharing love. That's all like amazing, and we could spend weeks on that. What really matters for us is Jesus knew all of that was going to happen beforehand. He knew when Lazarus walked out of the tomb, he would become a marked man. Not Lazarus, but Jesus would become a marked man. He understood perfectly well that the price of granting life to Lazarus was his life. That he could only do it by taking Lazarus' place in the grave. Jesus knew, and he loved Lazarus, and he paid the price willingly. You and I are in exactly the same position as Lazarus. We are on our own, on our way to death, bound for the grave. And Jesus knows that the only way to rescue us, the only way to give us the kind of death-conquering life we need, is to take our place. He can only offer us the life we need by offering us the life he has. Jesus knows, and he loves us, and he pays willingly. That's the cross. And in the resurrection, we find out it worked. The payment was enough. His whole life for you, that you might be granted his kind of life forevermore, that though Jesus dies, you may live. That's what we're celebrating today. That Jesus, in dying in your place, has given you his life. A life free of the fear of death, unbound and unencumbered by the agenda of trying to avoid death and stay away from suffering, free to join in the death-sharing love of Jesus because you have been loved all the way to death and out the other side into life forevermore. Believe in that. Believe in him and see what kind of life and love spring forth. Let's pray. Father, we give thanks. We need a bigger word than thanks, Lord. but we give thanks that you have seen us in our suffering, our sorrow, our grief, our futility, our looming death, and sent your Son to share in it with us, to experience it for us, and give us his death-conquering life. Help us, Father, by the power of your Spirit, to believe, to trust in the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus, to trust that Jesus is who he claimed to be, the resurrection and the life, to trust that in him, death is dead, love has won, and he has conquered, to trust and to love and to live accordingly. Amen. If you're able, would you please stand and let's sing of our living hope.